What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit Hyland.com.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
In association with Viatel Technology Group, IT leaders breathe easy with Viatel Managed Cybersecurity. Viatel.com.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, we're going to head to Boston to meet the biotech team using AI to develop new drugs. Our book club is here looking at the story of Steve Jobs' daughter. And as ever, I'll answer your tech questions. If you want to get in touch, you can do so by dropping me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. So last week, I brought you the show from Austin, Texas, which was quite fab. If you missed that, you should listen back on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. I met with the American Q. I met with Enterprise Ireland in Austin and the team behind Ireland Gateway to Europe, which is essentially a trade mission. 50 delegates go over to the US and not only build, but enhance and strengthen bonds between Ireland and America. It was an incredible week. And I'm going to bring you more stories from that trip over the next wee while. But I want to start with one man who I met in Boston. When I was there with Kieran Cudahy, we did the show, The Hard Shoulder, from Austin and Boston. And when we were in Boston, I told Kieran that MIT is one of the most fascinating places in the world to me. Because when I crossed the Charles River from where we were broadcasting in Boston Common over to the MIT campus, I was blown away by the size and the scale of it. Every single building is built with marble and glass, and there are different research centers for different kinds of cancer, different kinds of illnesses. And it just gives me hope to see that level of investigation and development going on to illnesses that, you know, have taken the lives of our family and our friends for many, many years now. But in amongst all of these buildings dedicated to research is a company called Flagship Pioneering. And Flagship Pioneering is a parent company of a number of smaller companies that are looking at different aspects of biotech and developing new biotech solutions. I met with Ho Kay Tam, who is the CTO of Monti Therapeutics, and he told me what exactly they're up to.
Flagship Pioneering is a company that creates new, primarily biology-focused companies that are platform companies. So these are companies that aren't just working on one product, but actually a whole range of products using some science or technology innovation that we tend to develop in-house. And one of the companies that we've created is Monti Health and Monti Therapeutics. And this is a company where we take a interesting and underexplored chemistry space. And this is a space of compounds that people have consumed for, in many cases, millennia, and as food, as traditional medicines. And we're really looking at using those and the bioactivity that comes from nature, because nature only makes these compounds that nature uses to do something. It doesn't make compounds that aren't bioactive. And we're using this space of compounds, which is very different from the chemistry that people typically use in drug discovery. So drug discovery compounds are typically primarily focused on, can a chemist really quickly make them in a very simple manner, right? And so that's how most drug chemistry is made. And we take an approach where we focus on the bioactivity of this chemistry space. And because of that, we're able to find chemistry that really hasn't been explored before for solving challenging problems and creating new drugs for chronic disease, which is where we're primarily focused.
And can you just explain a little bit about, how you choose what to look at. And is the scope bigger now because the technology has evolved and we can diagnose or pinpoint more issues than we could have, you know, even 15 or 20 years ago?
Yeah, so really the crux of the technology is two things, right? First, it's really that a lot more chemistry has been digitized over the past, you know, 10, 20 years. A lot of new technologies have enabled that digitization. And then coupled with these new machine learning and AI methods that allow us to efficiently sort through and predict which of these chemical compounds will actually have the desired effect. So for example, we have this set of molecules that we've curated that we think have these properties. This bioactivity has been consumed by people, potentially safe, right? And when we look at these compounds, if you were to try to make every single one of the ones that we're thinking about, it would take billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So we use machine learning to make this space possible to tackle. We also use it to figure out which of these compounds can you actually make in a reasonable time frame, and how would you do that? And that allows us to make this space, which was previously very hard to prosecute, something that you can systematically look for drugs in.
Mm. One of the debates that has cropped up a lot in the last 18 months, but I'm sure it's been around in your industry for a long time, is the balancing of the seesaw when it comes to the use of artificial intelligence, particularly in healthcare or medtech.
Mm-hmm.
How is that balanced? Because obviously, as we saw during the pandemic, people want a solution as fast and as safely as possible. But, you know, the scientific method, that there are so many steps to it and everything has to be checked, double checked and triple checked. So how do you balance that line between embracing the innovation for efficiencies, but also placing safety at the forefront as well?
That's an excellent question. So in order to develop a drug, right, there are many, many checks and balances, if you will, that we do to make sure that it will be effective in people and safe in people. And when we develop drugs with artificial intelligence, what we do is the artificial intelligence proposes this chemistry, but then we run through the same sets of tests that other drugs have to run through to make sure that, of course, that it's predicting mm-hmm. the right things, the compounds are effective and safe and doing what they're supposed to do.
Okay, and so does that mean then that there's always going to be a level of human oversight and interaction to ensure that the technology is behaving itself, but it also makes sense? Because one of the fear factors that I often hear is that people are afraid that the technology will evolve so fast that we won't be able to understand and correct it, and therefore we just place blind trust in something that we can't fully comprehend.
Yeah, I think one of the key the key points here is that, you know, we have teams that are comprised of drug developers, scientists, right, who are very good at what they do. And they take the results of this artificial intelligence and they provide a lot of oversight. So it's really not just an artificial intelligence selecting mm-hmm. what we go after. It's really a combination of both human insight and what the machine learning models can do. So, you know, the way I would think about some of these models is that they use the same type of human intuition that a chemist would use, right? You take these compounds, their structures, so they look like funny little graphs. Mm-hmm. And when a human chemist looks at these, they break it apart. So if any of you've taken organic chemistry, there's these functional groups, right, which are pieces of these little graphs mm-hmm. That have activities that are ascribed to them by humans. And what the machine learning system is able to do is take that same intuition, but apply it at a scale of millions of molecules and millions of interactions of these molecules. So even the best chemists in the world, you know, probably can't have millions of molecules in their head at once. Mm-hmm. And that's what our machine learning system enables us to do. So on that side, it really enhances human intuition. But then we have the checks and balances of the biologists, the drug developers, who make sure that the molecules that it's suggesting are actually the real deal, the ones that actually will have the effect that we desire.
I mentioned to you earlier on, I'm good friends with Professor Luke O'Neill, who you know as well. And one of the conversations Luke and I had recently was around the concept of a digital twin and how beneficial that would be to somebody in his field in immunology and biochemistry. Does that enable more opportunity for the trial and error and the advancement of the solutions that you guys are working on?
Yeah, I think a long-term goal, right, is really to think about how we model biology in sort of more of this digital twin manner. Many approaches to drug discovery are very reductionist in nature. They take apart the complexities and focus on one particular piece. One of our hypotheses is really that instead of looking just at these particular pieces binding to one particular protein or site of activity, what we need to look at is actually the broader spectrum of biology. And people see this when drugs have side effects. A lot of the times it's due to not looking at that complexity outside of the target that you're trying to hit with this particular drug. And so digital twin approaches that help us to model the complexity of biology will enable these kinds of drugs to be more precise, more effective, and have less side effects. And so those are the types of modeling approaches that, you know, are in the future that we're looking at as well.
Mm. And looking to the future with AI and, you know, quantum computing and all the innovations that are going on, is your team looking at, you know, future illnesses that we don't even acknowledge or are aware of right now based on environmental factors or the way fast food consumption is going, exercise, all of that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I think one of the things that the people who study chronic diseases are finding out now is that so many of these systems are interlinked with the inflammatory system at the root of many of these effects of things like obesity, of lack of exercise, and have been linked to diseases as wide-ranging as Alzheimer's in the brain, Crohn's disease in the gut, right, and even skin diseases like eczema. So as we think about how we modulate this fundamental biology using this chemistry that people have consumed for a very long time, these are new areas that we can deploy them in to look to solve for challenges that people haven't really use them for, mm-hmm. right? And that's how we think we can develop new classes of drugs with this chemistry.
Mm. And can you just explain a little bit about the process of, you know, working on a compound, developing something, thinking you have something, and then testing it on people? How does that work? Or, you know, I suppose I know that there's very strict regulations on drugs, particularly here in the United States. So at what point do you get to human beings and how regulated is that field?
Oh, as you could expect, right, there's lots and lots of regulations around the field. In the U.S. and in many other countries, you have to pass through a battery of tests to make sure that in various types of models, that model systems, so these can be cells in a petri dish, sometimes they're animals, and there are many debates about the ethics of that. But in general, before you test these things in a human, it has to pass through all of these other tests to make sure that the humans you put it through won't have a severe adverse reaction to it. And then the typical way people first administer these new compounds to humans is by giving them very small amounts and then ramping it up to make sure that the doctors are monitoring it and making sure that nobody is harmed in this process. You know, we think with some of our chemical space, because these are compounds that have already been consumed by humans, there's a less of a chance compared to these new molecules that have never before seen by humans, that these molecules will have a higher chance of having potential safety.
And for conditions that would be hereditary, for example, is there a notion of using some of your solutions as a preventative tool, say in younger people? So if, you know, a mother or a father has a chronic illness, but it only hit them when they were in their late teens or 20s, could a child start taking something that you guys are developing as a preventative measure to hopefully prohibit them from getting the same condition down the line?
Yeah, this is definitely an area that, you know, we're very interested in. Unfortunately, the way the drug development and regulatory system works, right? A lot of small companies like ourselves aren't able to immediately start with these kinds of preventative treatments. Because in order to make sure they're safe, that the risk is worth the benefit of the therapeutic, you need to have very, very large trials over very long periods of time to make sure that for healthy people, that they are not going to get any harm associated with these new drugs. We think that if our compounds prove out to be safe, as we think they will be, then there's definitely a path for broadening that out to patients with less severe or preventative indications. But for us, we are starting off with looking at patients with diseases. Can we treat them? And then because we're modulating the fundamental biology of those diseases, we're able to see if that works. You could imagine taking those therapeutics earlier and earlier in the process.
It is incredible, and it's very hopeful. Very often when we're talking about scientific and technological innovation, it can be quite scary. But this seems like there could be, you know, massive relief and peace of mind and solutions for people who live with these chronic illnesses. How long a process is it? So you mentioned something like Crohn's disease, for example. Is it viable that, you know, in the next number of years, be that 5 or 10 years, that this is a reality? Or what are the timelines? Does it work that way?
Yeah, so drug development is naturally a long process. Mm-hmm. And depending on the type of drug and what countries and how you do it, right? Yeah, 5 to 10 years is a reasonable amount. We expect to have compounds that could potentially enter the clinic, in the next couple of years. And that will begin a long process of clinical trials that will enable these compounds to get to patients. The benefit here for patients is really that many of these diseases don't have great solutions. And many of these diseases, if they have solutions, have solutions that are injections, have side effects that are pretty bad, remove your immune system, right? Those kinds of things. And so alternative ways to tackle these diseases are really needed. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people suffering from Crohn's disease, even from other skin conditions like atopic dermatitis, just have a hard time managing their disease. There's a lot of itchiness or lots of digestive issues, those kinds of things that really reduce their quality of life. And that's what we're hoping to solve with some of our new therapies.
Yeah. As I was walking from the, we were out in Boston Common, and I walked here, and I was taking note of some of the buildings that are around here. And again, it just makes my heart happy to see that there are buildings dedicated to, cancer research and preventative measures. What's it like working in this part of Boston where there is so much investigation and innovation in the world of medtech and pharmatech?
It's really a great ecosystem. So there's very few places in the world where there's such an emphasis on biotech and pharmaceutical innovation. Mm-hmm. And being in an ecosystem like this makes it much easier to find great talent, right? Smart scientists who are dedicated their lives to curing cancer, people who have worked on how you develop a drug and bring it to market. There's so many of these people around here and they're able to find jobs really rapidly that it enables this ecosystem of small companies to really thrive. And so that's really important, because without the small companies and innovation, many of the pipelines of these larger companies come from mergers and acquisitions of these smaller companies. So it really fuels the acceleration and the pace of technological innovation in biotech.
Yeah, that was Hoke Tam, the CTO of Monti Therapeutics, speaking to me in Boston last week. I am fascinated by the drug development process, being able to take compounds, putting them together and treating and hopefully eradicating someday illnesses that have plagued the lives of people for such a long time. And I think the conversation around the use of artificial intelligence in biotech development is fascinating as well, because as you heard in our conversation, there's a whole host of ethical questions. And at what point do you rely on the technology in order to make greater advancements or quicker advancements? But as you heard Hoke Tam mentioned there, you know, there's still that level of human oversight and human interaction in their processes. But it's just another fascinating, I suppose, tie to the world of artificial intelligence and another example of how it's beneficial. You know, we often hear these conversations around AI and they're scary and it's, you know, robots are coming from your for your job. That's just not the case in every instance, right? There's obviously going to be some work displacement. There are, you know, roles that exist today that won't exist in a few years' time. But when it's embraced and utilized in a responsible way, it can make huge leaps and strides for the betterment of humanity. That would be my take. But I'd love to know your take. Email me, techtalk@newstalk.com. Also, I'm wondering, because Andrea Gilligan was doing an AI week all this week on her show on Lunchtime Live. And she was talking about AI in the arts and in music and in the workplace. Where's the weirdest place that you've encountered AI that you're aware of? Because as I was saying to Andrea on Monday, it's everywhere. We just may not know about it. But have you found a bizarre but useful application for it? Do let me know. techtalk@newstalk.com. Now, when we come back here on News Talk, our book club is here once again.